My name is Eric Owens. I'm the associate director here and interim director this year at the Boisi Center, and I teach in theology and international studies. And it is a real pleasure to see a packed room for appropriately packed for Amy Harris's talk today, and what's the beginning of a two-day visit from Ms. Vilsack and from Amy around issues of how USAID can interface with Boston College's many student, faculty, resources, and programming. So this is a terrific way to kick this off as part of International Education Week, but also as part of the ongoing projects that we do here at the Boisi Center. We're delighted to reconnect with you, Amy, and I'm happy to have you all here. Before I get started, I'm delighted to hear that you called it USAID, because when I was growing up, that's what we called it, or that's what it was called as far as I knew. And now Amy's calling it USAID, so is this a generational issue, or?
Actually, the generational one is when I hear people who've been there a long time calling it USAID.
USAID.
Then I know, okay. Oh, these people have been here, because they're the ones who
they're old-timers.
They're there since it began, I think.
So. Well, it's nice to know I'm not an old-timer.
I interchange it, I think. I'm not quite sure what to call it. So.
Okay, I might slip into one or the other, but it sounds like it's appropriate either way. With that, let me introduce our speaker, and she can lead our way. Amy Harris is the Special Assistant to the Senior Advisor for International Education, who happens to be Ms. Vilsack, across the table, at the U.S. Agency for International Development. She serves as the primary support for the Senior Advisor in her role as the external face of USG International Education. She joined USAID in 2013 as a Program Specialist in the Center for Faith-Based and Community Initiatives, where she managed office communications, coordinated engagement opportunities for faith and community groups, and supported outreach to diverse members of faith communities. Prior to USAID, Harris worked in the NGO and private sectors, building experience that ultimately brought her back to international development. During her time at BC, she spent 6 months in South Africa. This is a semester abroad in South Africa, where she studied at Rhodes University and volunteered at a school for street children and a support clinic for people with HIV/AIDS. She was also an active member of the Arupe International Immersion Program, Appalachia Volunteers, and FACES. She's a native of LA, California, and her BA is in International Studies with a concentration in Political Science and Environmental Studies as a minor.
Yep.
Second major, all right. Everyone has to double major or minor here. Yeah, exactly. Please join me in welcoming Amy back to BC.
It is such a treat to be back here. I want to send my sincere thanks to Eric and the Boisi Center for having me. It really was such a treat connecting with you back in D.C. And it's really wonderful to be back here. So thank you to your tremendous team for coordinating our visit here over the next 2 days. I don't need to introduce myself anymore. That was more than enough, Eric. But I just want to say what a treat it is to be back here at Boston College. Beyond my deep love for this place, my work at USAID has really compelled me to be back, to come back for two different reasons that I think of are particular interest to Boston College. One, as an academic institution, and two, as really an incubator for men and women for others. But before I dive into those two things, I just wanted to take an opportunity to show you a quick 3-minute video about USAID's work, just to give you a general idea of what we do for those who are less familiar. And from there, I'll direct my remarks.
Our most basic common link is that we all inhabit this small planet. We all cherish our children's futures, and we are all mortal.
Today, we seek to move beyond the accomplishments of the past to establish the principle that all the people are entitled to a decent way of life.
Let us not forget that each child saved, each refugee housed, each disease prevented, each barrier to justice brought down, each sword turned into a plowshare brings us closer to peace, closer to freedom, closer to dignity.
America is a nation with a mission. And that mission comes from our most basic beliefs. Our aim is a democratic peace. A peace founded upon the dignity and rights of every man and woman.
We also know that progress in the most impoverished parts of our world enriches us all. So the United States will join with our allies to eradicate such extreme poverty in the next two decades by connecting more people to the global economy, by empowering women, by giving our young and brightest minds new opportunities to serve, helping communities to feed, empower, and educate themselves. By saving the world's children from preventable deaths. That's how we'll confront the challenges of our time. This is how we will seize the promise of this moment in history. Who are we to believe that today's challenges cannot be overcome? When we've seen what changes the human spirit can bring, that is why we look to the future not with fear, but with hope.
So as you can tell, USAID is a lot of things in a lot of places in the world. We work in over 100 countries, spanning work across all sectors: water, sanitation, global health, education. But before I go any further, I just also want to thank Christy for being here. We often go out to universities and are up on the Hill talking with members of Congress. But really at USAID, we like to call her our resident spokesperson because she's a great advocate for the work they do. So at any point, if I need something out, please don't hesitate to jump in. But to that point, USAID is a lot of things for a lot of people throughout the world. Being here on Boston College, I would like to keep my remarks fairly brief and really focus on two different types of partnerships. One being our partnerships with faith-based organizations and religious communities, and two being our partnerships with universities. And from there, you know, please feel free to jump in, ask questions what you like. But I, being back on campus, would like to make sure that Boston College is connected and engaged around and understanding what we're doing in these two areas. Particularly because USAID partnership is so key. In 1990, 90% of money that was going to other countries was coming from the U.S. government. Now, today, 91% of our financial flows going to other countries are from private sources of funding. And in light of that changing context, partnership is really more crucial than ever before. And we continue to cast a wide net of partners with our faith-based organizations, with our private sector partners, with our university partners, and far beyond that. Some of you may be surprised to know that USAID partners with faith-based organizations. Hopefully not all of you are. In fact, we have a long-standing relationship with faith-based organizations, have been working with them for longer than we've been in existence as an agency. In 2009, the Bush administration started the White House Network of Faith-Based and Community Partnerships. We now have centers at 14 different federal agencies that have an express mission to work with faith-based organizations. At USAID, we call that the Center for Faith-Based and Community Initiatives. And what we do at that center, as Eric mentioned, that's where I started at USAID. I was working in that office in a communications capacity and strategic engagement, kind of drawing on my love for working with faith-based organizations and trying to bring them more into the fold. Because the reality is, our faith-based partners have been working with the most vulnerable populations in the most remote areas far longer than we have been as a U.S. government. So at CFBCI, Center for Faith-Based and Community Initiatives, we work with faith-based partners to connect them with sources of funding throughout the agency. The center itself does not have its own special pot of money to do programming, but we help bridge connections with other parts of our agencies and missions throughout the world who are working on various programs. We also leverage our technical expertise within the agency. So, for example, if an organization is interested in specifically water programs or education programs, working with our technical experts who have a deep history in that specific sector. And then lastly, tapping into our larger network at USAID, we serve or act as a convener in a lot of different ways, bringing together multiple voices to the table, not only from the faith community or university community, but from the private sector, other bilateral, multilateral donors, and the like. And why do we do that? You know, if we're doing development well, we really need to work in local context, and we really need to work with the people we serve. History shows that we haven't always done that perfectly, but we're, in order to do our job best, we need to work with the people whose programs, bring them into the fold, and that oftentimes starts with religion. People who are motivated by religious reasons. We need to work with the religious leaders who often serve as speaker boxes and help us with behavior change and communications, who are able to help us reach communities in ways that we just aren't able to as a U.S. government. So how have we done that effectively? I could give you a million different examples of ways that we've partnered with faith-based organizations. But as you know, some of our biggest partners are faith-based organizations. World Vision, certainly Catholic Relief Services. We're working with them all over the world and across all of our sectors. Recently, USAID helped fund a center in South Sudan that CRS is helping us stand up, bringing together various communities, church communities on the local ground to help with peace and reconciliation initiatives. While I was at CFBCI, we also worked with the top three predominant religious leaders in the Central African Republic, the top Muslim leader, the top Catholic leader, and the top evangelical leader, bringing them to the table together in order to promote and spur dialogue, and with that, the communities that they have led. Many people ask, you know, well, can you work with all faith-based organizations? Again, oftentimes people are surprised to know that we even, as the U.S. government, we even do work with faith-based organizations. But again, we do, and they are some of our most valued partners. The only thing, because USAID is accountable to the American taxpayer, we have to make sure there's separation in time and space. So meaning that no explicit religious activities can happen in the same space or time in which their USAID funding is being used. But again, otherwise, we're working with some of the largest faith-based organizations, and we're also working with smaller faith-based organizations to bring them into the fold. It certainly doesn't hurt either, and I think this will be received with welcome ears at Boston College, that a religious leader like Pope Francis has really helped push our agenda. I had the good fortune of helping support an initiative at the Vatican, the first ever conference on impact investing, in summer of 2015, in which Notre Dame's Business School, Catholic Relief Services, the Pontifical Council for Justice and Peace convened the first ever conference to talk about impact investing and how the Catholic Church can support programming for double and triple bottom good. Since then, they again convened in this past summer, but he has really, Pope Francis as leader, has been instrumental in pushing the development community and bringing along specifically the Catholic institution, the Catholic leaders, Catholic organizations, bringing them together to think about how can we do aid, how can we do development, but in the most effective way to serve the people who most need it. He's also been huge in climate change. We've seen that with the Paris Accords and in Morocco, using his moral authority to really raise that issue. And it's been supported by this administration. And not to mention Cuba, bringing together an encouraging dialogue between our nation and Cuba has been huge. Having leaders like that who have pushed for a development agenda have been instrumental and really critical to our work. The other type of partnerships that I want to briefly touch on are our university partnerships. Christy and I, this past week, were over at MIT at the annual convening for the HESN, Higher Education Solutions Network, which is a group of seven universities that USAID works with to do research, to think about, to incubate and solve development challenges. So MIT is one of those schools, and there are several others throughout this country and one in Uganda that we work with. We also work and support the exchange of students from other countries to this country. Just a few weeks ago, I was in Kenya and met with a group of Yali Washington Mandela Fellows. This is a program that was started under President Obama and helps bring some of the brightest African students over to U.S. universities for 6 weeks each year and gives them experiences. Kristen and I have also spent time with some amazing female scholars from Egypt who have come here to various undergraduate universities in this country and several MBA programs to support their education. Sometimes, however, that's expensive and can be a little bit politically challenging. So oftentimes we've also supported the exchange of ideas and faculty from this country over to other universities. So for example, Arizona State University has sent a cohort of faculty over to Vietnam and helped build capacity at their top 8 engineering schools in that country. And when that's not possible, like it was in South Sudan when violence erupted in 2015, we've helped support bringing the first 8 female education graduate students from South Sudan and brought them over to Indiana University and give them opportunities for education. We also supported bringing some of their male faculty over so that they could really understand what these women were learning and to furthermore give them a support network when they returned to Indiana University. And since then, Christy, they've gone on and they're teaching in schools throughout South Sudan right now. Some of the lower hanging fruit too, we meet with university students all the time who are passing through DC and just want a taste of what working on a federal agency is like. It's really not that glamorous, but sometimes you need to see it for your own eyes to believe it. We've met with different fellows or connected them with other people within the U.S. government. And lastly, one of the other reasons why I'm on campus this week is for an initiative called the Global Book Alliance, which some of you might already know about because of Eric and his hardworking team. In short, the Global Book Alliance is a new global initiative. We're working with other bilateral, multilateral donors to change the way we are developing, procuring, and distributing books in local languages for early grade readers. It's this massive initiative that's going to take a long time to actually get up on the ground, but we need university partners, and we need specifically your help to create the books that we need in local languages. For the past, 6-8 months now, we've traveled to 6 or 7 universities and convened events around making books for children. So that's included working with the colleges of education, working with business students, working with local literacy champions, working with local diaspora communities, people who know the languages that we need books in. So tomorrow, we are going to be at this event from 4:30 to 7 and creating books right on campus. But the great thing about this new technology that we have, because technology is one of the critical pieces that is now allowing us to partner with people and organizations in new ways, different than ever before. The technology that's unique that we have is a free open source technology that allows us to create leveled and decodable books. So the books that you first learned how to read, the very, very basic books like See Spot Run and others of that nature. And this technology, you can pull it up on your phones right now and download it if you have a PC and start messing around and creating books in your dorms. Again, I want to keep this brief, but I'm trying to illustrate all the various ways that we're looking to create partnerships and partnerships that might be of particular relevance to all of you in the room right now. As we transition to the next administration, I think these kinds of partnerships are going to be more important than ever. And so I would really encourage all of you in the room to think about how you might get involved, because as much as we might not know what's in store, I can say with almost complete certitude that the problems that we face are not going to go away. And if I can just leave on one thought, and Christy has heard me say this a number of times, but I feel really strongly about it, and that's that as a millennial myself, I reject the sentiment that all millennials are lazy and not hardworking and don't stay committed to anything for any amount of time. I don't think that's true. If nothing else, Boston College connected me with a network of engaging, dynamic, passionate young people who continue to amaze me on a daily basis with what they're doing and how they're looking for ways to change the world that is beyond making a profit. And so I really encourage you to think about how, as an institution, as students, as faculty, BC can continue to be a player on this stage in whatever form that takes, whether that be with USAID, whether that be with CRS and other players in that space, other universities who you share the city with. I think there's a lot of ways to go about that, and I hope we can continue that discussion now.
Thanks so much. The event that Amy referred to, we're calling Stories That Move. One thing that Amy didn't mention about this is that the books are translated. Yes. There's a automated translation software involved that can put it into 50 or 70, I don't know, 50 languages or so around the world, and that's the reason that makes it so incredibly useful. We'll be video recording the event, so you'll be able to hear a children's book author who sold 20 million copies of books talk about his creative process, and then you'll be able to witness some of this by video. And, of course, the actual software itself is available for anybody in the world to download.
If you're not able to come to the event, we do have this handbook that we've put together That's not meant to be prescriptive, but it's meant to encourage you to think about how you might bring such an event to your either university community, your church group, your service organization, to think about all the various ways that it might be of use to you. So if you can't come, that doesn't mean that you can't be involved. So
Amy's very humble, but she actually created this tool. Having traveled to a lot of colleges and universities, it was something that she created that would make it possible for just about any student or faculty leader or community leader to take it and create an event much like the one we're going to do tomorrow.
Okay. So you can download it, but we've got a little cute book-shaped flash drive, too, for when we're working in developing countries and the internet is less than reliable.
That is very cute. So the floor is open for conversation on any of these questions. It's up to you.
Have you done this bookathon in the developing countries, in schools and colleges there? Just like this?
Yeah, well, actually, so two different things, yes. So we have been working on more serious, I say serious, but more technical workshops that span over the course of 5 days, and we're working with local teachers and librarians, and those books will be submitted to the various ministries of education to be reviewed, selected, and eventually packaged into a set of supplemental readers. Christy and I, as I mentioned, returned from Kenya about 3 weeks ago, and we were in rural Kenya in a place called West Pokot, and we were at a secondary school for girls, many of whom have fled from female genital mutilation or early childhood marriage and are at this school. And they're learning a very strong agriculture curriculum because that's where they are. They're surrounded by farms. And so the girls are quite amazing. But they decided that they wanted to create an alphabet book in Kiswahili, which would be illustrated with local plants, local flora, fauna, and all of it's in Kiswahili. So we did this in their computer lab. The electricity went out, then the electricity of the generator went out, but luckily we still had a few laptops with these plugged in them, and it worked just fine. And they were able to draw beautiful illustrations and package it up into an alphabet book. And alphabet books are really important because as you think about when you first learned how to read, that's really the first step. You need to identify the letters before you start chunking them together and creating words. So we need all types of books.
You talked earlier about behavior change and the importance of local religious leaders in that. How do the differences between local traditions and, let's say, official government-approved ethical behaviors, and how does the religious elements and the secular American government coexist within things like behavior change in Africa or in the Philippines or whatnot?
That's a good question. I think it needs to be addressed on a case-by-case basis. Where USAID has gotten most involved is really behavior change around issues of health. For example, when Ebola hit West Africa, specifically in Sierra Leone, they were realizing that the numbers of deaths were not going down. And in part, it had to do with because people had traditional beliefs about hand washing and burial practices. So USAID worked with World Vision, that has a strong, they've got a strong network everywhere, but specifically in Sierra Leone, and they trained local religious leaders around the practices of hand washing and what needed to be done when someone had passed. And so those religious leaders then trained some of their local communities. So, that's just one example, but it happens on a case-by-case basis oftentimes because we're seeing that it's affecting an individual's health or community's health. Do you have anything?
I was just thinking that there's, in Afghanistan, they're working with some of the imams to actually address issues of the importance of children getting an education. And rather than USAID coming in and telling people that they should educate their kids, that we tend to listen to our local leaders, whoever those are, whether it's the chief in an African village or if it's a religious leader. And if they're preaching, they're actually working with them to preach how important it is that both girls and boys get an education and that they have safe spaces to come learn and that they can actually come learn there in various religious spaces in places like Afghanistan.
What are some of the strategies that you use when you are working with those leaders? Like you said, for example, in Afghanistan, how are you able to work with them to kind of notify the importance of education for both genders?
One of the things that we're doing is that we're making sure we're a large government agency. We work with a lot of other large government agencies. We have lots of partners, as Amy said. But some of the most important partners are local, small NGOs. We're trying to empower them, give them the chance to work locally. So again, we tend to listen to people who we know and with whom we have relationships. So making sure that those organizations are working together and that we're sort of standing back and providing capacity building, but letting them take ownership is especially important. And that often is, in as is in our own communities, it's churches and local leaders, nonprofits that build relationships and get things done.
Mm-hmm. And this administration promoted something called USAID Forward, which is just putting metrics behind the number of partnerships that we have on the local level. So really trying to keep us accountable to what Christy's saying. And because that's where the most good happens when we're working with local partners.
I was on a mountaintop in Rwanda a few months ago, and it was bringing the whole community together, the grandparents, the parents. The parents and grandparents didn't know how to read, but they were making letters out of clay and using old cardboard boxes to make alphabet books. They didn't know how to actually read the words, but they did know their letters. And they were able to do that so that their children would be able to see that they cared, that they were learning to read. And it was pouring down rain, and as we were leaving, I realized we were in this space. We were supposed to be outside, but we were inside. And all of a sudden, I looked up, I realized I was in a Catholic church. I didn't even realize it. So, you know, you just blur the lines. That wouldn't necessarily happen in this country, necessarily. But it was interesting to me to come to USAID and realize that we couldn't do our work at all. Whether we're feeding kids, Catholic Relief Services works with us to feed kids. That the lines are really blurred, especially in places like Haiti and the Democratic Republic of Congo, mm-hmm. where you don't know the difference between the public schools and, you know, that's just the way the system works.
Yeah.
Joe, did you have your hand up?
Yeah, in your work on tackling poverty and extreme poverty in the world, what's the mix of providing people money to buy stuff they need, providing the stuff itself, like food and housing, and then or providing education and training so that they themselves can earn the money to buy the things that you then don't have to give them? And it's sort of in the short run and the long run, what strategies do you think work best?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think the goal is always last one, you know, providing, we're obviously a little bit biased though, coming from the education office, but providing people with education and training needed to really help themselves out of poverty, where that line is often most blurred, I think, is when we're working in humanitarian crises, either man-made or natural disasters, and specifically, we see this around food. You know, the response is often ship in tons of U.S.-produced food into a country so that people, or, you know, temporary shelters, any number of things that people need in the immediate in order to survive. However, we've seen that that's not always the most effective way, and it oftentimes can hurt local economies. It can push local farmers out of business. We've tried to navigate more of somewhere in the middle. We have oftentimes give people I'm blanking on the word right now, but like cash transfers or give them debit cards so that then they're able to use those technologies to then support local farmers and support local economies in the immediate while also being fed.
One of the things that people, and I'm an outsider to USAID, I came 4 years ago, and so I'm always interested in what I didn't know, how many things. I didn't realize that that we provide food, as Amy said, but we also provide instruction. So at the same time, there's humanitarian relief, which is what I knew about USAID, that we, in crises, that we show up, Syrian refugees, but that's the humanitarian response. But development's different than that. Development, the development side of our agency is about helping people learn how to do things for themselves, whether it's making water pumps or producing their own food through the Bureau of Food Security, or whether it's educating their own kids so that they don't need us anymore. And a lot, for instance, what we're doing tomorrow is about the democratization of creating books, that you don't have to wait for a publisher, or you don't have to wait for somebody to deliver those books to your village. You can make them yourself, or you can use your cell phone to demand of the federal government why they didn't get the books to your kids when they were supposed to be there at the beginning of the school year. So I didn't recognize the difference. I just thought of USAID as being a humanitarian organization, and I just fully didn't understand the development piece. But it helps to understand it, and I guess this goes to all of you who are thinking about jobs and maybe this world in the future. About 50% of the people who work with us at USAID are former Peace Corps volunteers. So John Kennedy started the Peace Corps. You heard his voice there a little while ago. And the same year he started the Peace Corps, he added the U.S. Agency for International Development to all of the agencies that exist. So there's defense, diplomacy, development in our foreign policy, and USAID is the development piece.
If I can just add one thing, we've seen corruption on both the humanitarian and development side of what we do, but part of, back to your question, part of why we're empowering local organizations, why we want to do that, is to help build their capacity as individuals, as organizations, as local governments, so that whether we're doing the humanitarian or the development work, they know a little bit about the mechanisms that we're constrained by as USAID or other bilateral, multilateral donors. They know how sort of things work, and they know how to respond accordingly within our limitations.
I have a macro question. I was interested in your comment that 90% of American foreign aid comes through private sources, and there used to be 10%. Is that fair? 100 years ago or so? Did I hear that? Right, it flipped completely. 20 years ago?
Yeah,
good Lord. Okay. So that doesn't necessarily say something bad, but it might say something terrible, right? And I'm wondering if, A, there's been a decrease in overall aid from America to other countries, humanitarian aid, as a percentage of GDP or whatever metric you might use. Has our delivery mechanism simply changed, and the good-hearted Americans continue to give so much money, or has there been a dramatic diminishment of our government's responsibility and efforts in that regard, and therefore our government is no longer representing Americans abroad in the way that it used to a generation ago? Is that a fair way of phrasing it?
Yeah, it's a good question. I can say that the pot certainly isn't getting any larger in terms of the U.S. government's resources for humanitarian and development work. So to that point, we've had to be much more strategic in bringing in more partners into the fold, particularly private sources of funding. We've done that through designing new funding mechanisms that are friendlier to private companies or universities or others, because we realize that working with USAID or other U.S. agencies can often be rather cumbersome and just frankly difficult. I would say we're now in a point in time where we're faced with more humanitarian crises than ever before. And so it's not a diminishment in U.S. government responsibility, not as I see it at least, but we're being stretched thinner than ever before. We've got DART's disaster assistant response teams in Nigeria, and one just went out to Haiti in response to Hurricane Matthew, in South Sudan and Syria, you know.
Nepal. I think there are six. I think there are more right now than we've ever had in
ever
history.
Before.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think what I was, to do all this and with the length of time in which a displaced person is away from their home is now 17 years. That's, you know, that's the education, as individuals' entire education. And so it's not just that we need resources for the immediate, but we need resources for their entire life, and that's a lot of money. And we're just faced with a massive funding gap. I think the number is something over $8 billion of money that is needed in order to adequately address the Syrian refugee crisis and all of its many facets. We're nowhere close to that, and the U.S. government is the largest international donor right now.
The American people think we spend about 30% of the whole federal budget on international aid when it's less than 1%. So we have a messaging issue where we need to help the American people understand that they're big-hearted, but they're misinformed about the work that we're doing, and we don't do a particularly good job of explaining it to them. So the work that Amy and I do, the public school system of Milwaukee, Wisconsin, of Denver, Colorado, pick the city, spends $1 billion every year on K-12 education. And we have $1 billion budget for both, for all education at USAID, and we work in 47 countries. So it's
basic education, higher education in over 50 countries.
Right. So people need to understand it in the context. So people have been less willing to give us those funds. So we have to make the case and help them understand why it's in their best interest for our own security, and also for building trading partners and prosperity in the future. But that's something that's a challenge for us. We actually think, and Amy talked about millennials, we actually think that millennials are one response to that, that this generation is so open to global issues that we're hoping that as you go on the tax rolls, if you're not already, that you'll be more open to seeing this as a wise investment. Maybe more so than a lot of the people who might be my age in the country right now.
But has the amount of money dropped precipitously? Has the USAID's budget dropped by 80% in 20 years, or has the percentage of private giving increased? Or that was one of
actually USAID's been getting more money from this administration. So, but the pot's not getting bigger. So my husband complains about that because he knows it's probably going to come from the Ag Department.
Her husband's the Secretary of Agriculture.
So, there's not more money for anything. So
yeah.
So that means it's how you divide up, and making choices. And so it's not that there's less money. And then there's something that's when sequestration happens and everything shrinks. So okay. There are things like that interrupt. But.
Okay. Yeah.
I just had a question, kind of going back a little bit, but USA, what are the strategies that your agency does when it comes across corruption? I know you work in countries that corruption is just a regular way of life. How does USAID go about addressing it without actually, turning into have to deal with the corrupt officials?
Yeah, well, and Chris, feel free to jump in. I mean, USAID is only working in countries where we have a relationship and an agreement with the government. So we have to assume that there's some interest in having us there. It doesn't always happen perfectly and in a vacuum, and there's zero corruption. But we have to assume that there's buy-in from the governments and from local partners. We've seen more of an increase in using technology to help us combat corruption. For example, I think Christy alluded to it earlier, but the one of the facets of the Global Book Alliance that I talked about, this big donor initiative or global initiative to change how we're creating and distributing books, involves tracking the actual books from publication to point of distribution and everywhere in between. So we put out this large, we call them grand challenges, but essentially told the world, we've got a problem, we need to figure out how to track these books so that they're not siphoned along the way and they don't make them, or they don't make them to classrooms, or only half of the shipment arrives, or they show up, you know, 3 months into the start of the school year. So through this grand challenge, we put out a call and received proposals for various softwares that let us use smartphones, because smartphones are pervasive all over the world, and scan them through barcodes and track them along the way. It also incorporates a software that ministers of education can look at and see, okay, this person's not doing their job, what's going on? That's just one example to illustrate that we're trying to be smarter and more efficient in how we're delivering our products and services, and technology is allowing us to do it. It's not always the solution, but it's helping us get there and helping us get to a more efficient solution.
A lot of teachers have to walk for 2 or 3 days in countries like this in order to get their money, and they often get it in cash, and they don't know whether they're actually getting as much as they deserve, but so they are out of the classroom for maybe 4 to 6 days just to get paid every month, so they're not with students, which means the kids aren't learning. But if we use mobile money, as we are in some developing countries, the money can go directly from the treasury of the country into the teacher's bank account. When we've done this in developing countries, the teachers all of a sudden think they've gotten a raise when actually they're just getting the always entitled to, you know, as many times as it passes hands coming up the mountain. And that often is used for political reasons, but so there, we're just finding that technology is helping us manage some of that.
We had another, Suzanne, and then we'll come back.
Maybe this is an overly simple question, but I'm curious with the new administration, and since you guys are a U.S. government agency, how that affects your hierarchy and your, how you, will you have a new director, will you both lose your jobs, what's going to happen here? How does the transfer of power affect you, I guess?
It's pretty amazing in our country that we have this transfer of power.
Absolutely.
You're watching that unfold on a daily basis. Mm-hmm. The most amazing thing, again, I'm an outsider, so is that we have all these different ways of hiring people. We'll just use USAID as an example. And so I'm actually a political appointee. The president asked me to work for his administration so that I knew that my job ended on the 20th of January. Mm-hmm. Anyway, as is my husband's, because we're both appointed by the administration. So every administration has the opportunity to place people in all the agencies, the executive branch, to make sure that their priorities get taken care of. So Feed the Future was a priority of this administration, the Bureau for Food Security. So that was a priority, powering Africa, making sure. So there were different priorities, and the political appointees are placed all over the federal government to make sure that happens. The career people, you know, they are amazing people there, and they keep the government going. Politicians come, politicians go. The government continues functioning, and they're in that mode now. That they will, because there will be a gap between the time that that the president comes into office and that even his cabinet won't mm-hmm. has to go through confirmation. Mm-hmm. So during all of that time, Raj Shah came in. He was the head of our agency. He came a year after, so we had no head for a year. So what happens then, as soon as we walk out of the door, the political people, then the career people step in, and they step up and they become acting this and acting that, and they continue to run the government. So they can do it pretty much without us. But obviously, it's an interesting dynamic. My husband describes it as the marathoners and the sprinters. So the politicians, you know, they only have 4 years or 4 years the most to get something done. And the career people know that they're for their careers, and there's this kind of a tension that goes on. When it works well, it works well to have that kind of tension. So the government does continue on despite that. Amy's a contractor, so she is hired by a different mechanism.
Yeah, so even though I work at USAID, my HR is another company, and that pays me.
She's not employed. You're employed by the contractor, and then USAID.
Right, an institutional contractor. But as Chris, it's like something like 28 different mechanisms in which you work at USAID, and the political appointees are the ones that have to leave at January 20th at 6 p.m. And the rest of all of the other 26 other mechanisms are there as well.
But Amy, could there be any other human being as qualified as you?
She's very humble, but let me say that, you know, I've never been on this campus before, and other than sports, you know, Boston College has been, certainly I know it's an esteemed institution, but your best ambassadors are the students that you graduate. So even if I never came here today, I thought highly of Boston College because there isn't anybody better out there. Yeah.
Here, here. Oops, Dan. Dan and then Joe.
Yeah, the primary partners that you've mentioned tend to be U.S. faith-based organizations that are engaged internationally. Are there other faith-based organizations that you're partnering with? So, for instance, I'm sitting here thinking, what is the role of faith-based universities? And I'm hoping you say nothing so we don't have more work.
No, that's not what I said.
But what about other, do you work with denominations? CRS is obviously denominational, but are there other organizations you have mentioned that we would know
about? We work with Jesuit Refugee Service. Yeah. They're obviously a large international one as well.
Right.
And I was trying to explain to Eric earlier, working with USAID is quite difficult. We require a lot of paperwork. So it's working with a religious or a secular organization from another country requires a great deal of capacity and ability to sort of navigate through our requirements. So we often see maybe working with a larger international organization that has roots or networks with smaller local organizations or denominational groups, and they're a subcontractor or subgrantee. That's based on their own capacity and ability to sort of work within our parameters. I'm trying to think of specific examples, but like in South Sudan, for example, why they might not be all recipients of one large contract. We're still reaching out to a council of religious players in South Sudan for the purposes of peace and reconciliation initiatives and tapping into their networks and their ability to reach other people outside of the fold, so to speak.
USAID hires our most valued employees are foreign service nationals who are not American citizens, but they work in country, and they have PhDs and multiple master's degrees. They're brilliant people, and many of them have worked for us for 20 to 30 years. Amy and I were bouncing around the back roads of Kenya a few weeks ago for 10 hours, and we were with one of our foreign service nationals who's an expert in education, and the driver who was driving us, who was also from Kenya. And so it was interesting to listen to them as we went through all the villages talk about the denominations, because the tribes, they were explaining to us that the Presbyterians are connected with this tribe of people. So the two people in the car with us were both from different original tribes, and then the Episcopalians and the Catholics, and so everybody kind of came over. It was geographical, you know, it's where you happen to land. And so those groups of people still identify with various denominations in this country, and so we certainly work with the Catholics, but in other places it may be a coalition of other denominations in this country as well. But I just found that really interesting to listen to them talk, and just having this conversation between themselves as we were listening in about how just sort of the geographical aspect of religion as it came to places like Kenya.
Joe, why don't you take our final question?
That leads actually right into my question. Does having this faith-based emphasis, is that ever a big disadvantage? Faith-based organizations do lots of good, but on the other hand, lots of wars are at least correlated with or based on religions. And are there cases where this religious focus is actually a problem, because religions can be exclusionary. I am, you aren't, and so on.
Well, we don't discriminate. We, you know, put out our proposals for anyone to apply to, be them faith-based or secular. It's who's most qualified and who's going to distribute good services to the most people and not discriminate to those beneficiaries.
But in a lot of places, too, to your point, is that there are religious tensions in places.
Yeah.
And so providing equitable access to education, there are groups who try to exclude other people. And so one of our goals, that humanitarian goal, and that, again, was something new to me. I hadn't really thought about it. It's like, well, you're providing education, or you're providing the textbooks in these three local languages, but in doing those three local languages, you may have excluded indigenous people, and you may have, by not creating a textbook for them, or by putting in a school in a particular place, just access-wise, you may have excluded. Or in Nigeria, for instance, the North, we work in Islamic schools, actually. We just want kids to learn to read, so we've had to figure out how to do that. But you always have to take into consideration those things that you're talking about, because you can sometimes do more harm. When you think you're doing good, you can sometimes do more harm if you're not really politically aware of where you're putting something, or whether the teachers you've hired are all from one particular organization or one particular religion. Again, girls' education in South Sudan, girls have to go to school to women. So in the case Amy was talking about, we only had two women in South Sudan with an advanced degree. And so you can't, it's a chicken and egg thing. We had to get more women into those college positions in order to get more girls in school. But I had never really thought about, you know, you just think about putting a school, getting the books, putting the teachers in there, but you can do harm.
Interesting. Well, thank you both, and especially Amy, for this terrific presentation, and thank you all for being here.